Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll talk about what brings people back home to the mountains of Appalachia.
I've come to understand that homesickness is simply an intrinsic longing for a place that's encoded into your DNA.
We'll hear from people who have gone to great lengths to get back to these mountains.
You know, it's one of those things where you're trying to balance all of the various expenses in life. I did had to work very hard to make ends meet here for a long time.
And we'll hear about what happens when people finally do come home.
And I told my husband at the time, you get me back to good old West blank Virginia, and I ain't going nowhere again. So I've been right here ever since then.
Can the reality of home ever truly live up to our memories of it? On this episode of Inside Appalachia, the struggle to return homesick for Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Living here my whole life, I'm familiar with how eager many of us are to leave Appalachia. Some are looking for fortune or fame, while others are just looking to get away from economic hardship. But plenty of Appalachians also hold tight to their deep roots here and look for ways to make it work, despite the challenges. We explored this push and pull in a series we just wrapped up called The Struggle to Stay. Many of you connected with the stories you heard in the series, but not all of you could empathize. Take Roger May, a photographer who moved away from West Virginia when he was 14 years old. He had a different reaction.
I think my initial thought was, you know, I'm coming at it from a very limited perspective in that I've always been wanting to get back to West Virginia, you know, and that I finally landed. And having been here a couple of months, you know, to see that series be launched, I kind of shook my head a little bit and was like, well, what about the struggle to get back, you know, because I feel like that's another side to the story as well, and there are probably other folks like me who have fought tooth and nail and gone through a lot to be able to get back.
Roger has been homesick for almost his entire lifetime. For the 35 years that he lived out of state, he continued to try to find his way back. He even founded a project called Looking at Appalachia, a crowdsourced image archive of the region. I spoke with him shortly after he landed a new job in southern West Virginia, fulfilling his lifelong dream to come home. Why was it so difficult to get back?
Well, at the time, when I got out of the Army, I went back to North Carolina because there were more jobs there than here, so that was a big factor, which is still a very much a factor. And then I was a single parent for a while, and I needed a job that provided benefits, you know, for my kids and you know, good health insurance and so on. And then you get to raising kids, and you know, kind of stay put for a while to provide stability for them. And that was the main driving force. And then, you know, one child was in college and one child finished high school early to start college. And the timing of it was just such that it seemed like a good time to be able to get back.
You mentioned there's probably a lot of people who have moved away and, you know, would love to move back. And then you also talked about your challenges in trying to get back here, which obviously everybody has a unique story. But if you could paint a broad picture, perhaps, like, or even some specific things that might make it or have made it a little easier for you to get back, or even for others who have moved away that would like to get back, what is there anything specifically that you think needs to change to make it easier for folks here?
Well, I don't think it's ever been an easy place to live. I don't think people expect that at all. I would just encourage people to, you know, stay at it. I mean, it took me a long time to be able to get back, and I don't ever plan on leaving again. And you know, it's worth it. You know, it's worth it to be here. It's worth it to be in a place that historically, you know, was born of struggle. It was, you know, it was born out of struggle. All throughout this state's history, we've we've known struggle. It's no stranger. And I've never met anybody from West Virginia, anywhere else in the country or in the world, that wasn't trying to get back at some point, whether it was just at Christmas time or whether it was just in summertime for a family reunion or something like that. I've never encountered more proud people. And there's something about that, you know. And you know, I occasionally hear people say, well, West Virginia is a good place to be from, you know, and I think about that and I'm like, yeah, but there's more to it. It's a good place to be from, and it's a good place to be, and it's a good place to get back to.
Our show connects with people who live right here in Appalachia, but our podcast listeners also include folks who want to learn more about Appalachia or people who are homesick for this region. No matter where you live, you tell us it's a way to stay connected to Appalachia. While we were producing this show, we asked for your stories of homesickness on Twitter, and we got back a variety of heartfelt responses. One of these came from John Henderson.
Hi, my name is John Henderson, and I was born in Texas. But I moved to Tennessee 20 years ago, and I always felt more at home here than any place I've ever lived on earth. A couple of years ago, I was doing some research, and I found that my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, William Campbell Fox Hunter Mayfield, was actually born in Washington County, Tennessee, in 1783. When I found that out, it all started making sense. Why, every time I went to East Tennessee and did hikes in the mountains along the Appalachian Trail, I felt a peace. I've come to understand that homesickness is simply an intrinsic longing for a place that's encoded into your DNA. I think people get homesick for Appalachia for that very reason. These mountains, this culture, it's a part of you. It's inexplicable and it's inescapable.
A place, like John Henderson put it so well there, can be as inexplicable as it is inescapable. So that's what today's show is about. We're spending this episode talking with a number of people who tried to put down in words why this place is so special, why residents from Appalachian states like Kentucky and West Virginia have such fiercely loyal connections and often a longing to return. We'll try to wrap our heads around this intangible, mysterious thing called homesickness. You can join the conversation, too. Share your story about leaving home or maybe, like John, about finding a new home in Appalachia. Our Twitter handle is @InAppalachia, or you can write us a message at InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're talking about homesickness. Several of you who've reached out to us over the years have described stories of your childhood spent in the mountains and a longing for years gone by. Here's one of the letters that one listener recorded.
Hello, my name is Terry Tincher. I grew up in Whitesville, West Virginia, in Boone County, and now live just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. For me, homesickness is a desire to return to a much simpler place and a simpler time. Homesickness is being connected to the mountains and actually having the mountains within my soul, within my blood. It's the history of the region I grew up in. It's the culture of the people. It's my friends, my family. It brings back memories and thoughts of walks in the mountains and finding old mines and derelict stills, walking across swinging bridges and holding on for dear life, and many other memories of growing up. My mom and my dad. Dad picking flowers and bringing them home to mom from the mines and having that peculiar smell of coal dust. And that battered old lunch pail that he always brought home that just don't see anymore. Once the mountains of Appalachia get into your soul and into your bloodstream, you can't ever leave it behind.
Terry pointed out that for him, homesickness was not only a longing for a simpler place, but also a simpler time. But the reality of home doesn't always match our fantasy of it. Is it easier to feel that sense of nostalgia for home when we don't have to deal with the day-to-day reality of living here? Life in these mountains can be a struggle. So when we move away, is it easier to romanticize Appalachia? Our next guest wrote an entire book based on the tension between his own mixture of romance and reality. Jesse Donaldson is author of the book On Homesickness, A Plea. Part of the book is a memoir about his relationship with his wife and his desire to move back to Kentucky, where he grew up, from Portland, Oregon, where he lives now. In the book, he also writes about nostalgia and what it means to romanticize a place you've left. The book is also filled with history and folklore from communities throughout Kentucky. Each county in the state gets its own chapter. Jesse recently wrapped up a book tour in which he visited every county in Kentucky, and at each stop, he read a passage from his book. In order to visit all 120 Kentucky counties in 28 days, well, Jesse had to get a little creative.
So if I was, if there were people there, I would do a little bit more of the book and give them a sense of the book. But I always read, at the very least, the county passage in the county. In some cases, if you're going to do 120 stops in 28 days, a lot of the times you're not necessarily at a library or a bookstore. It would have been impossible. So in some cases, I read to cows on the side of the road. But also, I have a number of people show up in some interesting places. So I read in
You seriously read to cows on the side of the road?
Yeah, like in Casey County, I stopped by this daylily farm and read, and there were just cows there. So I read.
And why was there just not a venue, or you just?
No, you couldn't do it. You couldn't. I have 28 days that I could manage to get away from my wife and child and having to make money and.
I'm sure the cows enjoyed it too. That was.
They didn't seem. You know, they seemed not charmed by the work. They were a little bit critics, but someone could have shown up. I mean, someone could have shown up theoretically if they had found out about it. So the other example I'll give is that. I read at Pequa Cemetery in Robertson County, and three folks showed up to this little small county cemetery in a small town. I read in Egypt, Kentucky, and I had written about how it was named Egypt by a man named Samuel Amix back in the early 19th century, and his great-granddaughter and her daughter showed up and listened to me read above at the headstone of their ancestors. I mean, things like that were really nice.
Yeah. Did you find that people, when you read it, you know, came out and connected and were familiar with some of your stories? And how did they react most of the time?
I think in general, people were really warm to the idea of what I was doing. I would kind of tell my story and they would ask me questions and then I would ask questions and there'd be sort of an exchange. And so actually the Robertson County one's kind of funny. That particular section in the book, I think it might be all of seven words. I mean, it is very short. And it's the precise moment in the book where the book becomes much less about Kentucky and much more about what's happening in my own life. And so I kind of went in and apologized almost in advance. And I said, I'm sorry, this is seven words, and it's not really even about Robertson County. And Robertson County happens to be the smallest county in Kentucky. I don't know by population, but definitely by square miles. And so we talked about that, and they were like, well, this is perfect for Robertson County that we get this little small section, you know, like, I don't know. I mean, Kentuckians are really warm. Maybe they're just being nice to me. I mean, Kentuckians tend to be pretty nice when you talk to them. But really, I think people engaged with the idea of someone wanting to kind of traveled to all of these places and at least at the very least put on a reading if people showed up. And I have to say, like, I think at almost half of what I call the side of the road readings that are literally just out in a public place, usually like two people would show up. And it'd be really fun.
I'm speaking with Jesse Donaldson, author of the book On Homesickness. Jesse says the inspiration to write this book came from his own desire to move back to Kentucky.
It was in my mid-30s. My wife and I had just had recently relocated to Oregon, and we had been living in Texas before that, and I had lived in New York and Iowa and Costa Rica and Ohio and all around. And so the move to Oregon started to feel a little bit more like a more permanent sort of feeling. And so I think that's where this sense of homesickness started. And I didn't intend to, I had written a novel and I didn't really intend to have this be my second book, but I just kind of started to write little bits of sort of short micro essays or about Kentucky myth and lore. And then a little bit, I was just trying to understand my own desire to return there and try to figure out whether or not that was, in a way, whether or not it was a true feeling or whether it was, you know, some other sort of malady, like general depression or anxiety. And so I think I just started to write myself into the project a little bit and see where it went. It was a bunch of post-it notes up on my writing board for a long time.
In the book, it's broken down by counties, the counties in Kentucky, and there's, if you open it up, there's a picture of the county and sort of, you know, roads that might go through it. And then on the right page, you've got about a paragraph usually.
Yeah, so I basically created a form, and that form was that each county has a reference to that county. So they are meant to be married together. Sometimes these are very specific references. For example, Clark County is about the story of George Rogers Clark, who is named after, right? Or Nelson County tells the story of Jesse James shooting up the Talbot Inn, which is in Bardstown in Nelson County. So it's a historical event. And sometimes the references are as thin as sort of wordplay with the county name or some aspect of the culture or history of the county. But basically, I just created a form where I'm telling this story about homesickness. Very much it's the story about my life in Portland, Oregon, and it's addressed, it's called On Homesickness, A Plea. It is written to my wife. It's written to an audience of one trying to convince her to move to Kentucky using Kentucky history and myth. And then each county has a little reference to that county in there. And I say some of them are thinner and some of them are more direct. I mean, but that's sort of the form that I gave myself to explore. And to be quite honest, eventually I break down the form, though I do that for, you know, creative nonfiction reasons. The form that I create kind of falls apart by the end of the book, but almost on purpose, you know. As the plea to move to Kentucky falls apart, so does that structure that I built for the book.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Pendleton County. If I could read this passage, you wrote, "As a boy, I was told to be placid in the face of anguish, to be courageous in the face of danger, to step forward when the floodwaters rose and the tornadoes landed. But now I ask myself, why do men romanticize sacrifice? And why do they ask it of women so freely? Is it merely biblical? I hesitate to cast you as the lamb. The other day you told me about an internet quiz that matches personality with state. The quiz was based on research published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. It said, I belong in New Mexico."
You know, for me, there's two big parts that are going on in that section on Pendleton County. It's the first is an admission that what this idea, this book that is a plea for my wife to move to Kentucky, is inherently selfish. It doesn't necessarily take into account her desires, right? And that's one of the major sort of like tensions within the book is that being homesick for a place that's your home but not someone else's home can become a very solipsistic and almost egotistical, selfish endeavor. And then the second part is there's this like myth that like Kentucky would care that I was gone or something like that. You know what I mean? Like I identify so fully as a Kentuckian, and I just thought it humorous that this quiz said that I was not, that I was from New Mexico, right? I mean, I think that quiz is kind of BS, you know, but and I got New Mexico. My wife got Georgia, you know, like who knows? I don't know what you I almost thought about going back and saying what permutations of these answers do you have to get to get Kentucky, right? But it was more just kind of it was a moment to kind of laugh and laugh about the ridiculousness of this idea that that a place could actually want or belong you, or that you could, or that even that a quiz could actually tell you that seems kind of ridiculous to me, right? Like I don't belong in I have no desire to move to New Mexico, and I don't know what in my answers typified me as someone from New Mexico, but I know that it's false, right?
Now we're going to hear Jesse read a bit from his book, On Homesickness, A Plea, recently published by West Virginia University Press. Jesse says that if his book is one part Kentucky and one part his own personal life, the middle section, where this passage comes from, is an attempt to find a balance between the two.
So, Adair County, 1802. I've become the sort of person who prays away his problems. And though this capacity for delusion makes me weak, I've also learned the world is filled with surprise. In 1999, a Kentucky cattleman phoned a state forester about a chestnut tree on the edge of his land. It boasted uncharacteristically long leaves, teeth that curved inward, reddish stems. This is how we discovered one of the last mature American chestnuts. Castanea dentata is rare, having been devastated by fungal blight for most of the 20th century. Scientists believe this particular chestnut survived not because of its strength, but because it contracted a virus that weakened both tree and fungus. Isn't it strange how two illnesses together can help a thing survive when either alone would bring death? Sometimes I want to believe that you and I are that lone American chestnut, that we are survivors, but such romantic notions are full of hubris. Better the notion that I am the fungus to your virus, that together we might find balance and keep something alive between us.
So is that about your relationship with your wife?
Pretty much, yeah. It's kind of my view on, I'd say it's my view on how cohabitation and marriage and partnerships sort of work. Or it's like, I like that view. I don't know if that's my view. I know that when I wrote about that tree, I found that I thought that that was a really great metaphor for how a relationship can thrive and not be idealized, right?
By being a fungus and a virus to each other, like breaking each other down.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, this tree is really unique. I just want to point this out. Like, American chestnuts don't actually exist. I mean, they do, but this is the one real one that exists in Kentucky, and it really only exists because it has these two afflictions or illnesses. Otherwise, it would have died. And so if you see an American chestnut in Kentucky, the chances are it's 15 parts American and one part Chinese chestnut. That the hybrid has been made to repopulate the tree. It looks like an American chestnut, but genetically it isn't. So this is the one mature genetic American chestnut that exists. And it does so because there's a balance between these two different forces on the tree. So so it's kind of like a, yeah. I think that in a weird way, cohabitation and life and figuring out where you're supposed to live once you have a partner is about filling in one another's imperfections and making one another the best version of yourself, right? So fungus and virus together seem to work.
Today, Jesse and his wife are still living in Portland, Oregon, because that's where his family can make money. Jesse says this is what makes sense for his wife and their child, but he still holds on to the dream of moving back to Kentucky.
So I still look for opportunities that fit my family's life to return to Kentucky, right? But I wouldn't just take any opportunity to return if I thought that would negatively affect basically my wife, Becca, and my daughter, Poe. That would just be selfish, right? And that's the, you know, that's the balance of like that. That's like, you know, in 2017, we kind of and for a long time, the story of America is you go out and you get your education and you follow career paths and you do the Horatio Algiers, you know, make something of yourself and follow opportunity. And that's largely, I think, true. That's one great thing about America. What that sometimes does is it takes us away from maybe like the ancestral places where we feel we belong or the families that we grew up in. And reconciling those two things isn't always as easy as I would like it to be, is kind of the gist of the project, right? If I could reconcile the life I built with the life that I kind of was born into and have those things kind of come together in a symbiotic way, I would sign up immediately. The reality hasn't proven that simplistic.
I think some people might just say they don't care, that they're just moving and deal with it and suck it up.
Oh yeah, my wife Becca is not particularly nostalgic for she grew up off the Appalachian Trail, or her house literally backs up to it in Pennsylvania. I don't think she's in any way particularly nostalgic for where she grew up, and has no desire to return home. She's a very different person from me, in that sense. And I've met plenty of people like that that are not nostalgic for home, or you meet plenty of people that don't even really have a sense of. They couldn't tell you where they think home even is, right? I mean, you see that oftentimes with people who might grow up in military families where you move from base to base so frequently that essentially they're nomadic in life. There is no home. There's no sense of this is my home. There's just the sense of a bunch of places that I've been. Like I said, the book itself is a very personal. It's a very personal book. I mean, I happen to be someone who's nostalgic for things and slightly romanticizes things, and then it interrogates those impulses a little bit.
We just concluded a series called The Struggle to Stay. What was it like for you in trying to come back to Kentucky? What did you find, and what were some of the challenges to be able to come back here to Appalachia?
The biggest challenge in my own personal life is the fact that having left Kentucky and gone out in the world, I acquired a wife, a partner, and a life partner, and so now we have two people whose careers and aims don't always align necessarily in terms of both work or location or place where they want to be. So the biggest difficulty I had is that the sort of work that my wife does, her career, it exists in Kentucky, but not on the same level that it does in Portland, Oregon. It would be harder for her to advance in her career and make the same living in Kentucky. And then the same is kind of true for myself. I work as a freelance copywriter when not trying to write books, and I have there's much more work, there's much more opportunity to do freelance copywriting in Portland, Oregon. It's a bigger business there.
Now that it's written and you still live in Oregon, how do you feel?
I mean, it depends on the day. Like, I brought my daughter back for a week to Kentucky for the tour the first week, and I got to see her, spend time with her cousin, and who lives next door to my parents. My sister lives next door to my parents, and I kind of could romanticize and idealize this life where we also lived in right next door, and that they got to be around one another and spend time with one another. I consider Kentucky home, like that's my home. But when my daughter was getting on the plane, she said she was going home, and she meant Portland, Oregon. I mean, that's really what the book addresses. It really addresses this idea that you could be at home in a place. And you can know that this place feels like home, but that the people that you tie yourself and the life that you lead takes you away from there. And how do you bring those two things together? Or they don't always come back together. So I still want to return to Kentucky, but I don't want to do so and uproot my family without reason other than my own homesickness. That seems like a pretty shallow reason to uproot other people's lives.
So Jesse stayed put. But writing on homesickness did give him a good excuse to come home to Kentucky, at least for the month he spent traveling the state on a book tour. After a short break, we'll hear from people who felt this homesickness but who moved back. Did their memories of home match up with reality? You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Ridge Mountain, in my head, an overflowing fountain. Oh, my heart is a Blue Ridge Mountain. But I never, never knew, I never knew, never knew, never, never knew, never knew.
While we were producing our Struggle to Stay series, which featured Appalachians who were deciding whether they wanted to stay or leave our region, we heard from several listeners who said there was a side to the struggle we weren't covering. The struggle to return home. Some of you have worked for years to make it back home to Appalachia, like this next person.
My name is Ann Lockard. I was born here in Charleston, and I live in Danville, West Virginia, in Boone County. I think that West Virginia is a place that you don't identify as much like in your brain, but it's something that's in your bones. It's something that if you're from here and you are a part of this culture, it's just something I think that stays with you. And I really think that all of Appalachia just has a unique experience that is just not replicated anywhere else in the United States. I think that's why people miss it so much. And I think that that's why people are so homesick and, you know, long to come back, even if opportunities, you know, preclude them from doing that. Many years ago, I actually had an opportunity to work construction, and I traveled over most of the United States, and I went to a lot of different places with a lot of wonderful people, but I never found a place that I could call home more than West Virginia. I absolutely wanted to come home, and I was, you know, once that opportunity ended, I absolutely took the first opportunity I could to come back here and work. I think that there are definitely a lot of challenges here. I did had to work very hard to make ends meet here for a long time. I was fortunate that I was able to persevere and get myself into a position where I am able to support my family on a single income. But of course, it's still difficult. You know, it's one of those things where you're trying to balance all of the various expenses in life. And I can understand why some folks, you know, have to seek opportunities elsewhere.
Earlier in the show, we heard from Roger May, who recently moved back to West Virginia after nearly a lifetime of homesickness. Roger says that for him, it was good timing. He's noticed a lot of energy among other people who've moved back or who are proud to be staying.
I think it's an exciting time to be here for people that either are considering leaving or who are considering coming back, people that have come back. People that have never even thought about leaving. I think it's an exciting time to see this wave of this sort of resurgence of pride of in West Virginia and involvement in grassroots organizing. And you know, there's a point at which you just can't take anymore. You know, and you have to do something about it yourself. And there's no greater way to do that than to move here and be a part of the solution.
Two people who typify this resurgence that Roger's talking about are J.D. and Jenna Belcher. They've each found a way to earn a living doing what they love to do, and in one of the poorest counties in the nation, no less. They both grew up in McDowell County, West Virginia. Roxy Todd recently visited them to hear more about why they decided to stay put and how they found a way to remain here.
J.D. Belcher is a former coal miner from McDowell County, a community that's usually in the national news for high rates of addiction, poverty, and unemployment. And while there are grim statistics here, 36% of residents are living in poverty, J.D. Belcher says it's still the place he wants to be.
Coming out of high school, I didn't really, you know, like all of us, I didn't really know what to do. So I enrolled in college and tried that out for a few weeks and decided it wasn't for me. So I dropped out my first semester, and then I said, well, I'll go back next semester and we'll try it out. Maybe I'll switch majors and we'll see what we can do. And that lasted a few more weeks than the first semester, so I dropped out again.
From there, he began studying to become an electrician, but then a job came his way, transporting coal across southern West Virginia for a company called, at the time, Massey Energy. But then when the coal industry began to take a downturn, he was laid off. Eventually, he got a job working for Bluestone Coal in Wyoming County. It's just across the border from his home county of McDowell.
I got on there and spent the next 7 years of my life as a strip miner, heavy equipment operator. And eventually, I just wanted to, you know, I've always been very creative. I've been in bands. I've, you know, sculpted. I've drew things. I've always done something creative, and I just eventually got into wanting to learn how to make a zombie film. So how do I do that? I asked myself, and I just started learning everything I could, and it just kind of had a snowball effect. And eventually I learned so much that there was a position for a production editor in the local area. And I took a 50% pay cut and a huge decrease in insurance to take a chance and do it in the productive world.
This new job was at an advertising agency, about an hour from JD's home. After a few years making commercials with them, he started getting side jobs filming weddings. Last year, he decided he was making enough money at his own video business that he could quit his full-time gig at the ad agency and work as his own boss. He and his wife, Jenna, now own two multimedia businesses together.
Thankfully, we've had a very lucky first year, and things are looking really good, and I get to be my own boss and do what I love for a living. So, you know, so far so good, and we'll just see how it goes. But that's where we're at now, basically.
JD says he still keeps in touch with several of his old coworkers at the surface mine. Although many of them were laid off for several months a few years ago, he says most of them are back to work now at Bluestone Coal. Still, he feels happier now that he's making videos, many of which are about his home of McDowell County. He was recently contracted by the McDowell County Visitors Bureau to produce a video and a website called Meet McDowell to help promote the area's bed and breakfast and local restaurants.
And it was basically more of a love letter to my home, you know. No matter how much you knew McDowell County, we wanted everyone that visited the site or watched the film to find something that they never knew existed. And we definitely had that experience too. I think there's close to 20 lodges in McDowell County that you can stay at. I had no clue. There's close to 20 restaurants. There's so many recreational activities to do, you know, especially with the four-wheelers, as we all know. But there's really a lot of people that are being highly successful and just are at that level from just word of mouth. So we thought, you know, if we can all get behind a certain campaign for the entire county and just to show these business owners we have their back, like the sky's the limit. So it's definitely had a great response so far, and people seem to be really enjoying, you know, the positive energy that it's created.
JD's wife, Jenna Belcher, is a former banker who now works for an economic development nonprofit called Coalfield Development Corporation, which recently expanded into McDowell. Because of the sense of connectedness she feels here, she says she could never see herself being as happy if they were raising their daughter anywhere outside of southern West Virginia.
She's three, but we don't ever want to take her out of a situation where we stop at the gas station and know five people that are there, or three people, you know, hold the door open for us when we walk through and use their manners, and we know, you know, the grandparents of and grand, you know, great-grandchildren that and people that I grew up with, their children that our daughter can grow up around. And I don't think that we would want to raise her anywhere else. We don't want her to think that, you know, that by any means it was easy to stay here for us, because I'm sure with JD's talent, you know, we could have gone somewhere and probably made, you know, three times as much as he's making now. But my family is invested here. Our family is invested here. We've been very blessed with the economic situation in McDowell County. You know, we were able to grow two small businesses. I was able to get a college education. We've been comfortable, and, you know, we've been very lucky here. And I don't think that we would want to raise her anywhere else.
That was Jenna Belcher and her husband, JD, speaking with Roxy Todd in Kimball, West Virginia. We've posted JD's video called Meet McDowell about McDowell County on our website. That's at wvpublic.org. Like Jenna Belcher, several other listeners say they stay in Appalachia because they want to be close to the friends and family they grew up with. It's also the reason why some make the decision to return.
Hi, my name is Nikki Meadows, and I'm from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, which is located in Mason County. My husband John and I lived in North Carolina from 2002 to 2015. While living in North Carolina, we experienced varying degrees of homesickness. Sometimes homesickness would be spurred by a simple trip home for the weekend, visiting family, and we would question if we had made the right decision in moving. Sometimes homesickness would be spurred by something that we would hear on the news. For example, the Upper Big Branch mine disaster really brought about a bout of homesickness. My family, we come from coal miners, so that was a very difficult tragedy to hear about. In the time that we lived in North Carolina, both of my grandparents passed away. My father-in-law had a massive heart attack. We experienced a miscarriage and was later unable to have children. Dealing with all these things, being away from our support system, was definitely difficult, and it made us homesick for the sense of community that we had in Point Pleasant and the support that we received from our friends and our family. After all of these things happened, we decided that it was time for us to move back to West Virginia. So even though we experienced homesickness on different levels, the ultimate thing that brought us back to West Virginia is the sense of community. Those of us that have grown up here and have experienced the things that we have, we all have that in common, and no one can ever take that away from us. We are stronger because of it, and it makes us better people.
Thank you, Nikki, and thanks to all of you who sent in a message about how you experience homesickness. Our final segment in today's show is part of our ongoing series, What's in a Name, where we explore the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This week, because we're hearing from people who feel lost when they're away from home, today we're going to visit a town that gets its name from someone who was lost. So, how did Lost Creek, West Virginia, get its name? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. Claire Hemme set out for a small town in Harrison County, West Virginia to find out how Lost Creek got its name.
In a little town right off I-79, you'll find a single road, one restaurant, 400 residents, and not much else. But ask anyone a question about Lost Creek's history, and everyone will direct you right to Miss Hilda Knight.
I am organist at my church, the Lost Creek United Methodist Church. I am also on the town council. And otherwise, I'm retired.
Hilda sounds humble here, but she's considered the town guru for all information on Lost Creek. She's also a grandmother, a retired teacher, and genealogist who knows the town like the back of her hand. Hilda made it very clear from the beginning that she loves Lost Creek and has no desire to be anywhere else.
I lived 2 years in Omaha, Nebraska, hated every minute of it, and I told my husband at the time, you get me back to good old West blank blank Virginia, and I ain't going nowhere again, so I've been right here ever since then.
Hilda agreed to meet me in one of her favorite spots in town, the local library. She took me up to the second floor where we sat in mismatched chairs beside the window. She brought along a book with her, Reflections of Lost Creek by Willa Curry, to tell me the real story behind the town's mysterious name.
It was not because a little stream lost its way meandering among the hills that the little town that grows up halfway between the county seats of Harrison and Los County was called Lost Creek. While wild creatures of the wood and an occasional Indian were the only living creatures in or near the present site of this village, an exploring party of three men was sent from Wheeling, the only post or civilization in western Virginia. They left Wheeling in the early spring and journeyed onward till they came to Blake's school near Lost Creek.
The book goes on to explain that the three men disagreed on what direction they should take. Two of them went towards Buchanan, while the third turned towards Harrison County. In the spring, the two men returned to Wheeling, but the third never joined them. A new party of explorers were sent out and found the bones of a small man at the head of a ridge over a creek.
This was believed to have been the man who deserted the party of explorers the previous spring. So that's what we were always told, that the gentleman's remains were lost by the creek.
Before I left, Hilda wanted me to know that living in Lost Creek is not as easy as it once was. She explains that much like other areas of the state, drugs have found their way into Lost Creek.
It used to be very nice. Like I say, I've lived here all my life, never felt insecure or scared of anything, but with the drug situations all around everywhere, it's really not good, and we're trying to figure out what to do to help eliminate that.
Regardless of the troubles that the town faces, Hilda refused to end the interview without a final comment on her relationship with her hometown.
People are very friendly, not as much today as was then, but I love my town. Been here, like I say, except for 2 years, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Hilda may live in Lost Creek, but she certainly is not lost. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Claire Hemme in Lost Creek, West Virginia.
If you have another story about Lost Creek or ever heard of another town that you wondered, how the heck did they come up with that name, send us a tweet at In Appalachia and we might explore it inside Appalachia. While growing up in southern West Virginia, I had big dreams. I was introduced to this idea that in order to be somebody, you had to move away, so I always wanted to leave. My parents often told me not to settle here. I'll admit, that dream never left, but plans changed and my family here just became more of a priority. So I've lived in southern West Virginia for my whole life, and I guess the only time I've been homesick is maybe a little when I was on vacation. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Josh Armistead, Dog and Gun, Lobo Loco, Blue Dot Sessions, Ben Townsend, and Hooray for the Riff Raff as heard on Mountain Stage. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martique and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Roxy Todd and I produce Inside Appalachia. Catherine Moore edited our show this week, and Xander Alloy mixed this episode. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence, and you can find us online on Twitter at In Appalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. You can address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget, you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.